This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. Today, Peter, we're going to talk, it's Mental Health Week at time of broadcast here in Victoria. We're going to talk about grief and loss and the aspects of grief and loss that touch all of our lives. Most of us at some stage, in fact, all of us at some stage, will go through a point in our lives where our partner, a parent, or somebody close to us will die. And it's one of the facts of life. Everybody listening to this show, at some stage, no matter how young or old you are, it's one of the common things that connect us all throughout all of our multi-communities. Grief and loss are part of the human experience. They're part of growth, and they're part of understanding yourself. I've been through some grief and loss, but not as much as other people. But the significant effect of grief and loss is different in all people. Have you been through grief and loss, Peter?
Well, of course, my parents died about 30 years ago. A close friend of mine died of HIV. That would have been about 10 years ago, I suppose.
My partner that I was with for 12, 13 years died in 1995. In very horrible circumstances. It was a very slow, lingering death. We're going to be talking to Carol Ann Allen, who's a psychotherapist and specialises in this area. And we're also going to be talking to some people from our who are part of our radio station here in Melbourne, 3JOY, Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station. We're going to talk to Leanne Renfrey and Anita Gibbons, and they're going to share their experiences and the loss of their same-sex partners. And also I'm going to share my experiences as we explore the issues and the effects of grief and loss in the community. I'd like a welcome to the show, psychotherapist Carol Ann Allen. Hello, Carol Ann.
Hello there.
And welcome to the show.
Well, thanks very much.
Carol Ann, tell us a little bit about yourself as a psychotherapist.
Well, I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, state licensed in California. Mm-hmm. I have been living in Australia now for just about a year, and I had a practice for 12, 13, 14 years, something like that. One of the important areas of work was working with people who had lost partners, lost family members, or were in the process of caring for a terminally ill partner or parent or family member. And I did that as working with individuals, with couples, with family groups, and also with groups of individuals in a group setting.
Can you tell us a little bit about the process of grief? What actual a grief and loss when somebody loses somebody? I believe that there's two situations that perhaps might put this into context. There's when you know somebody's going to die and the unexpected.
Well, yes, and even within those two general areas, there are so many different ways that death can occur. And each of those particular ways has a significant impact and influence on how one is confronted with loss and confronted with grief at that time. If there's an accidental death, if there is a long-term illness, if there is a death through violence, each of those different areas has its own special challenges.
I think one of the other areas that would be terribly difficult to deal with, because it would be a two-pointed situation, is when you have somebody who suddenly becomes severely disabled or has a stroke, and then the partner or the family, they have to deal with the grief and loss of the person in a lot of ways, but they then also have to try and deal with the fact that they have to look after them now as well.
Well, that's right. And, you know, when you are taking care of a loved one who is in a debilitated state or a progressively debilitating illness, you're losing that person bit by bit all along. And in some cases, say in the case of a stroke, where there may be a catastrophic loss of functioning of that person at one moment, they're still there, but they're not there in the same way. And so some of the particular characteristics of living with a loved one who is in a process of dying, the grief begins, as you said, you know, at an earlier stage. It begins before the actual death has occurred, and there's a renegotiation of roles that you have in the relationship, you know, going from whatever the optimal sort of role balance of equality is that you had in the original relationship when everyone was well, to more of an unequal relationship of dependency that develops. Yep. And we don't always sign up for that.
Carol Anne, one of the things that's happened in the gay and lesbian community, and particularly for gay men during the 80s and the 90s, is we had a huge community that was all in an incredible state of grief because so many people died in our community, so many men died from AIDS and HIV. And I apologise if this is putting fear into the eyes of the listener, but dying from HIV generally is a terribly distressing way to die. It's a lot of people go through a lot of suffering because it's such a slow and debilitating, very much like cancer in the ways that that goes. And we had a whole community that was in grief for quite some time. How are some of the ways grief manifests themselves in people?
Well, in the case of being close to someone dying with AIDS, dying with cancer, it's a traumatic experience. It's a traumatic experience to witness, to participate in. It's very frightening, and it's one of the things in a death from a long-standing illness that may be different from a sudden death that occurs, is that there are two losses that happen simultaneously. One is the loss of the person, and the other is the loss of the illness. And paradoxically, there are two things that may go on for someone and the surviving partner in that case. One is an experience of relief that the suffering of the partner is over, and so that the loss of the illness, in a way, is actually comes in some relief.
It's interesting people's reaction sometimes to the death of someone close, because I know a friend of mine who cared for someone with HIV and cared for them when they went downhill and eventually died. And there was an assumption from his friends that it would be a relief for him that he didn't have to worry about this person anymore. And he said, no, it's not a relief at all. I wish they were still alive. I wish they were still here.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's the other part of it, which is that you also have lost the person. Sometimes, though, in a debilitating illness, that loss of the person, as we were saying earlier, starts to happen at an earlier stage. And the end of the illness provides an opportunity through the rituals of memorials and grieving to reconstitute person as they were known to you in their healthier times, and to recreate that person that they were in your as part of your grieving.
Our special guest at the moment is psychotherapist Carol Anne Allen, who specializes in grief and loss. And we're going to have a track, and then we're going to talk to Anita and Leanne, and we're going to discuss our personal situations and a little bit of our stories about losing our partners. And then we might talk in depth with Carol Anne towards the end of the show, if we can sum up our experiences and perhaps come to a conclusion. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo on the Community Radio Network across Australia via satellite with Adam and Peter. Our special guests today are discussing loss and grief. I'd like to introduce to the show Leanne Renfrey. Hello, Leanne, and welcome.
Hello, Adam. Hello, Peter.
And hi. Anita Gibbons. Hello, Anita.
It's good to be with you.
It's great to have you both here. And can I just say that Anita and Leanne are both presenters here on 3JOY, and they've come into Allegro today so we can discuss this important issue and hear a little bit about their personal stories. Anita, we'll go with you first, I think.
Okay.
Anita, tell us about your partner.
My partner is Maureen, and I met her when I was 21. We've been together for 36 years, and in 1979 she developed breast cancer for the first time, and she had three more bouts of it up until 2001, and then last year, She got cancer of the esophagus, which was a result of the ray treatment that she'd had back in 1979 for the original breast cancer.
So the breast cancer therapy actually contributed to the esophageal cancer.
That was one of the hardest things to deal with, I think.
Oh, goodness. That would be hard.
Yeah, and she passed away, 14 months ago now.
I remember.
You know, it doesn't seem that long, Anita.
I know.
It only seems like just a few weeks ago to me. And, I mean, I've known you. How long have I known you now? We've been in the radio station for about
15 years.
Yeah. And so the process of dealing with this illness, was it a gradual one, or did it change as time went by?
Well, you know, the thing is, when somebody's had three bouts of cancer, you sort of learn to take it in your stride.
You've developed the coping mechanisms, and here we go again.
Yeah, and that's what we thought it was going to be, but unfortunately, she had a heart attack, and that stopped the treatment, so there was really no way that she was ever going to recover from it.
Was there a turning point when you suddenly realised this is it? She's not going to recover?
She says that she did, like, a month after she was diagnosed. I held out for a bit longer, I think, and I really reached the bottom in May 2007 when I thought, this is it. But up till then, I thought, well, you know,
maybe there's a chance. We might bring Leanne in at this stage. Hello, Leanne.
Hello.
Can you tell us about your partner?
Yeah, Jennifer and I met at work in 1998, and we got together later that year. She was actually been diagnosed with breast cancer when we got together, and was, I think, still having chemo at that point. But I didn't think she was going to die. She was a young woman. She was 40.
It's one of the most curable forms of cancer.
Exactly.
Breast cancer and prostate cancer seem to be relatively high success rate, like up in the 90% for cure.
So, yeah, no, she was young, she was fit. As far as I knew, the sort of prognosis was good. She had, you know, some surgery and chemo and radiotherapy. And
she was full of life.
Absolutely.
I remember meeting her.
This is a thing, though, when you're reasonably young and you meet someone, having to go through this is the last thing on your mind when you first meet, isn't it? I mean, you don't imagine that you're going to have to go through all this soon. As well.
No. I mean, you know, early stages of a relationship, someone having chemo, it's probably not the most romantic.
No.
But it was something that we were sort of prepared to get through and get her well and on with it. And she recovered very, very quickly. I mean, she was at work every day after radiotherapy. She was in it, had the 8 o'clock a.m. at Peter Mac, and worked across the road at one of the government departments, was at work by 8:30, didn't miss a day, I don't think. And she was fine, and we lived together, and it was not until about 3 years later she complained of a sore back, and she'd been doing a lot of gym. She was running 5-10K three or four times a week. We'd been horse riding, and she complained about a sore back, and the physio said, look, you should be getting better. I think you need to go and we need to have a back x-ray, and he rang that afternoon and said to her, I'm not a doctor, I can't advise you of the result of these x-rays, but I suggest you come pick them up and make an appointment to see your doctor. And we thought, it's a bit weird. And as soon as the doctor saw them, said that she had secondary bone cancer, and it was just the pelvic sort of back area. So she had a full scan, and she had secondaries in her liver, and she had
goodness.
Bone cancer.
So. Well, did they attempt to treat it?
Yeah. She had 7 months of chemo, apparently the longest amount of chemo that anyone had ever had at St. Vincent's. And that actually did shrink the tumours in her liver. But she was pretty sick through that. And for all intents and purposes, around sort of May 2002, they said that the tumours in her liver had shrunk and the bone cancer wasn't causing any issues. But what I was unaware of was that chemo does not, because you have a blood-brain barrier, so nothing in your system, like an infection, can't go to your brain, otherwise you die. Chemo doesn't go to your brain, so therefore if there's something growing in your brain, the chemo
is not going to affect
it. And she ended up getting brain tumours.
Oh, goodness gracious.
And so she went downhill pretty quickly from there.
Okay. So was there a point when you realised, and she realised, this is it?
Yeah, I don't know about her so much because with the brain stuff, a lot of her cognitive function disappeared, so she wasn't really able to articulate how she's feeling. What I remember being significant is that at the time that we got together, she said, I'm going to beat this, you know, I'm going to be fine. And she was fine. And then when she was diagnosed with the secondaries the year before she died, it was, I'm going to fight this. So it was much more of a battle rather than a knowledge that she was going to be well. And when the diagnosis came back about the brain stuff, she was a lot more laid back, not giving in, but a lot more, it'll be, what will be, will be.
Okay. Did you find that your relationship, during the course of all this, that your actual relationship changed?
Yeah, significantly. I think early on with the diagnosis the second time, she was in charge of her treatment and I was the support in that and took over a sort of carer role, but she was still the sort of primary person involved in that. As she became sicker, I became the sort of primary person. So I was the one dealing with the doctors, dealing with the family, her family, and our relationship changed very much from equal partners to me being a carer.
Did the same happen for you, Anita, when Maureen got sick?
Yeah. In fact, it got to a point at one stage where I just threw my hands up in despair. I couldn't cope with it. They reached a stage where for 2 weeks she hadn't been able to keep any food or liquids down and she was just turning into a sack of bones virtually. And I kept saying to her that she needed to go and see the doctor and do something about it. And she said, well, there's nothing they can do. And she just wanted me to sit there and watch her die, and I couldn't do that. So that's when we managed to get the stomach peg, and they were feeding her directly.
I met my partner in 1983, and I won't go through the whole histoire of what happened, but he ended up with another chap. They both became infected with HIV, and over a period of years, developed complications from the HIV. He was well for a few years, but then he got cytomegalovirus and he got quite a few other things. And then there came this period when the cytomegalovirus turned into ulcerative colitis, and he also got CMV on the brain. And his cognitive abilities weren't affected, but he was in incredible pain, and he spent 8 weeks in hospital while they put him on a drip to try and control the cytomegalovirus, and he actually came good and he went back to work, but he'd lost all his body mass.
How did you deal with watching your partner in pain, knowing that there wasn't a lot that you could do about it?
Look, I don't actually know. You just do. You got no choice. You have to deal with it, and I did that. What compounded the issue was his mother came to live with us and his son, and they all hated me. As you know, his father is gay because of me. My son's gay because of you. And if he hadn't been gay, he wouldn't have been in this situation. So I was there being the blame. So I was more concerned about dealing with that. That was actually harder for me to deal with.
Because his mother was going through something similar to you, maybe, but at a greater distance.
I know, she came to live with us. It was very, very intense. But the thing I won't forget is the look on his face towards the end of his life when he was in hospital, because he fought every step of the way. He didn't want to die. He really didn't want to die. And he couldn't breathe. He ended up getting pneumocystis, which is like a fungus growing over the lungs. So he had to gasp for breath. When he couldn't breathe, the look of fear on his face will be with me to my final hour. And there was nothing I could do to help him, just be there. So,
because a lot of people are putting this situation basically without choice. So, you know, when they choose a partner, they don't choose the illness that follows with it. So they're sort of, they're there by default, basically. And how does somebody deal with that if they think this is too much for me, I don't want to be in this situation.
We'll ask Carol Ann when she comes back later in the show how people actually deal with this and what they do. I guess it's the same for Anita and Leanne. Really didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
No, I mean, people said to me, are you able to cope with this? But, I mean, you say yes. I mean, I felt...
You can say no, but you do.
That, but I felt a sense, not only responsibility, but I guess pride in the sense that Jennifer let me be the number one. She gave me that trust, had that trust in me to care for her, so I wouldn't let her down in that. So I just tried to do my best through it all. But you don't know. As you say, you're not prepared for what's going to come.
No.
People can talk to you and tell you what it's going to be like, but until you're going through it,
yes, exactly. And you can make all sorts of arrangements, I suppose, in the event that something like that might happen. But will you stick to that if it does happen? I'm just thinking specifically of my situation. My partner's quite a few years younger than me. And the noble part of me says to him, look, if I ever get sick for some reason, just put me in a home or something, because you've got a lot of your life still to live, you know. Mm. I don't know that I'm going to think that way if I became very sick.
Can I just share a little bit of a funny thing? Here's a couple of things I just wanted to tell you. One of them was my partner and I, when he realised he was going to be sick and he was likely to be debilitated with his illness, he said to me, can I ask you to do something? And I said, yes, what is it? Knowing what the question was, but he says, if I ever get to this stage, and he came up with a list of conditions, could you make sure that I don't have to suffer anymore. Mm. So, and I said yes, but when those conditions arrived, he then went into this absolute paranoid panic that I was actually going to do what he'd asked me to do.
Mm. For the first time in your life, probably, Adam, not you.
I thought, he wanted me to do it while he was well and happy.
Yes.
But at the end of his life, he suddenly wanted to cling on to life. And he was an atheist like me. And the other thing he wanted was a priest.
Yes.
He wanted to get in touch with his spirituality.
It reminded me of the friend of mine who had HIV. And he had all these conditions that if he gets beyond a certain point, then he wants to end his life. And he even found a book somehow about how to end your life and everything. When it came to the crunch, he did not want to die.
Not many of us do. When we had Dr. Rodney Simon, Neil Francis in from Dying with Dignity Victoria, they did tell us that most people who request euthanasia, when it comes, in fact, one third of people, when they the time comes and they have the ability to do it, they don't want to do it. Mm. Leanne and Anita, did your partners at any stage want to die?
Well, Maureen always talked about it, and she did. In fact, one of the funny things that happened was about a week before she actually died, the doctors had decided that maybe it was too much to keep feeding her and they were going to stop feeding her. And her reaction at that point was, what, so the plan now is to starve me to death, is it? you know, just that I'm not going to give in to this yet. I'm not ready to go yet. But in fact, as I say, about a week later, when they gave her the option of taking the cocktail, she decided that she would.
Okay, so they gave her the option to be able to take something to help her die. Leanne, what about Jen?
I think we always had those discussions that you have when you're fit and healthy about, if anything ever happens to me and I was in an accident, I don't want to be a vegetable or, you know, whatever. So we had that level of discussion. But as things became sort of serious and I guess far more relevant, she didn't want her life prolonged in any way. So because she was not able to speak or really wasn't that conscious for quite some time before she died, I just really went with that decision, talked with her family about it. So as we were given options by the doctor and palliative care nurses about when to stop oral, when to stop food, when to stop liquids, those sorts of things, I just tried to respect her wishes and not artificially prolong her life, yet make entirely sure that she was pain-free and as comfortable as possible. So.
That was going to be my next question, is the amount of pain. My partner was in absolutely excruciating pain. So much so that we have to call the nurse, because we tried to keep him at home as much as possible, had to call the nurses in the middle of the night to come and give him morphine. And sometimes it would take them 4 or 6 hours to get there. They had so much to do. So they ended up teaching me how to do it. Mm-hmm. So when he used to get breakthrough pain, I just used to give him injections of morphine. And I said to them, how much? I said, well, this is how much you should give them. I said, what if I gave them 5 times that amount? I said, well, that would be a lethal dose. None of them said to me, and they just looked at me and let me know that if I did that, that's what would happen, but I didn't. But the only time I ever used the injection, this is a rather black bit of humour here, he was very aggressive when he was sick. Mm-hmm. He was terribly angry and very aggressive, and he couldn't get out of bed. And he asked me to make him breakfast one day, and what he asked for we didn't have, so I made him something else and I took it up to him on the bed. And our house is very tall houses, 7 levels, and our bedroom's on the top floor, and about 4 levels down is the kitchen, and the bedroom's landing sort of juts out over the kitchen. And so I made him the breakfast, and he said, I didn't want that. I said, I'm sorry, there's nothing else. I can't go to the shops, you have to have this. I told you I wanted such and such. I said, Keith, just have this, I'll get that for you for tomorrow. You effing little bitch, da-da-da-da-da. I said, look, just eat it, because I'm not cooking anything else. And I walked downstairs. So I got to the... And he was really sick in bed. Mm-hmm. So I got to the kitchen. The tray and the contents landed on the floor in front of me. He threw the whole lot down. So that particular event brought so much pain, he ended up on the floor. And I picked him up and I threw him in bed. And I said, you need a shot of morphine, don't you? I said, yeah, I got the biggest bloody needle. Like a 7-gauge, it was like a knitting needle, and I stuck in his backside. And he screamed, "You bastard!" I said, "Well, you threw the tray at me and squeezed the morphine into him." We're still having fights.
I was going to say, from what you said, that sounds like normal behaviour for the two of you.
Have you ever considered taking up nursing as a?
Yes, I think giving lethal injections, probably I'd be pretty good at it. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo. Our special guests today, Anita Gibbons, Leanne Renfree, and Carol Ann Allen. We're talking about grief and loss here on Allegro Non Troppo.
Allegro Non Troppo is produced at radio station 3JOY and heard nationally on the Community Radio Network.
We're talking about grief and loss. We have with us in the studio chatting at the moment Leanne Renfree and Anita Gibbons and myself and Peter. And Anita and Leanne and myself have all lost partners. And we're talking about grief and loss in this context of losing partners. Anita, did you do anything in your life to prepare yourself for Maureen's death? Was there any particular things that you did?
No.
In preparation, no. What about you, Leanne?
No, not really. I think because I had a period of time to sort of get used to the idea, I think subconsciously you prepare. Mm-hmm. At times I would think about life without her, like what it would be like, but I'd stop myself thinking about that because it was almost superstitious, or I felt guilty because I was thinking I was going on and she wasn't. So I would sort of go forward in time, but then it all got too hard and I would sort of withdraw from that, so...
Your partner died last year, Anita.
Yes.
When did Jen die, Leanne?
2002.
Okay, mine died in 1995. Now, when my partner died, I was just into the internet. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I was one of the first people I knew to get on the internet. So I looked up everything when I knew the end was coming about ways of dealing with grief. So what I did was, in the last few months of his life, he tended to be okay from about 11 o'clock at night till 3 in the morning. For some reason, during those hours, the pain was minimal. He was coherent. So I spent the last 3 or 4 months of his life. We used to sit up at night and we'd made videotapes when we'd been on holidays and things. And we played all the videotapes back. Not with, this is the end of your life, let's rewind. Mm-hmm. But that's actually really what we were doing. We hadn't done it consciously. I rewound our relationship for the 12 years we'd been together and played it back with him and re-experienced a lot of the things we'd been through. And I really think that helped me when the end of his life came, because there was some sense of a conclusion. I'd been through it all. We'd relived what we'd had. I had the opportunity at quite some length to say goodbye to him.
We actually did that too, like 3 days before Maureen died. I'd managed to get all of our home movies put onto DVD, and I took it into the hospice, and we played our way through as many as we could. But she, by that stage, she was getting very tired, and, you know, 3 hours was about the maximum she could sit through. But that didn't help me at all.
Okay.
No, we didn't do that. I think, again, it was because Jen wasn't really sort of quite with it. I found it very difficult after she died to get those last few days or that last week out of my head. That was my focus. Now, maybe if I'd done that, I would have had the relationship in more perspective. I don't know. But I found it very painful to actually revisit the good times till probably several years later, to actually let myself think about the good times and enjoy it rather than feel bad about it.
Okay.
Jen died at home. So I guess in a sense also that was with me at home a lot too, that the time she died was sort of there. So every time I looked where the bed was.
Can I ask you this? This is a really difficult question for you to answer, and I'll go first. What was it like when your partner died, the actual moment? My partner died in an absolutely horrific situation. You know, they say that the dying process is peaceful and quiet and everything. Mm. It wasn't for him. He choked.
Mm.
And it was just, it's one of the most horrifying things I've ever seen in my life, and it'll be with me forever. And sometimes I wake up and during the day I think of it and I lose my bundle, getting upset thinking about it now. Mm. But he choked to death and it was absolutely horrible.
Similar with Maureen, she had taken the drug, as I mentioned, and about 3 hours later she woke up and coughing and couldn't sort of move the phlegm off her chest, and she threw up, and about 10 minutes later she turned around, looked at me and started to say something, but it was all garbled and I couldn't understand it, and then the nurse just came around the other side of the bed and said she's gone.
Okay. Mm. Leanne, do you remember the dying moment?
Yeah, I remember Jen was probably more coherent in the last 24 hours than she had been for weeks before. And I guess almost that was a sign that she was going. And I had a friend of mine who is a nurse with me, and she said, don't be frightened because she might start making noises and what is commonly referred to as, you know, the sort of death rattles, whatever. Yeah. And she said that can go on for a very long time. So, you know, if she seems to be taking her last breath and we all holding our breath, then she'd breathe again and we'd all breathe again. But that actually didn't go on for too long. And she just stopped breathing. And it was actually peaceful in a sense that it wasn't traumatic, perhaps like you've described. But still, you still can't believe it sort of happened. And the other Jen, the nurse, took her pulse and said, I think she's gone. She said, no, I can feel a pulse. And we all almost went, oh, no. Like, we almost wanted her to be dead, because it was like we'd got to that point. Yeah. And I thought, if she's going to keep, like, you know, I've only got a minute amount of energy left for this, and I'm sort of stringing it out. And if she's going to keep going, I'm going to get really cross with her. But she wasn't. It was actually her own pulse that she was feeling, because she was so tense and upset.
The other thing, immediately after the death, after your partners had died, I felt guilty about it. I had this huge sense of relief. I was relieved that he wasn't suffering and that I wasn't going to suffer. And, you know, in the hospital, they cleaned his body and everything up. And then they asked us to leave while they took all the tubes and everything out. And they cleaned him up and they made him look really peaceful. And I got back into the hospital and I climbed in bed with him.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that.
I remember my friend, as I said, I was very close to him. And I was with him and his mother. And his mother just stepped out of the room. We knew he was about to die. His mother stepped out of the room to go for a cigarette. So I was with him and I had my hand on his arm. And he stopped breathing. And I thought, well, that's it. And then he took another breath. Mm-hmm. But he took two more breaths before finally that was it.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I just had an emotional moment. The best bit of therapy for me actually was to climb back in bed with him.
Mm. Mm.
That's right.
And then I had a tug of war with the relatives over the jewellery.
It's quite funny because my friend who was very sick, and I went to visit him in hospital. I was there till 11 o'clock at night. They were quite okay, the nurses with me being there. And he asked me if I would give him a hug. So I lay on the bed and put my arms around him. And the nurse walked in and she looked shocked and disappeared very quickly. And I thought, why are you feeling shocked? I mean, it's not exactly as if we were having sex or anything. Mm. I was just holding him, you know.
Did you, either of you do anything like that? Like
I had some time with Jen. Her mother was with us when she died. And so I had some time with, I let her mother have some time with her. And each family member, because the sisters arrived, had some separate time with her. And then I just had, and I just really said goodbye in my way. Just gave her a kiss. And but I didn't want to be in the house when her body left.
Was it rude? Okay.
And that was the thing. I'd said to my friends, I'll do everything up until that point. So they just walked me, one of them walked me around to the pub for a drink. They'd already arranged with the funeral parlour to sort of be out the front. And that was the bit I didn't want to see.
Anita? Was Maureen in the hospital?
Yeah, Maureen was in the hospital. I'd spent like most of the previous month with her. So it really wasn't all that different the day she died. Okay. Yeah, I just gave her a hug and she was gone.
We're running out of time and I have so many things I want to ask you. Was there anybody or anything that was particularly moving for you after they died? I just want to tell you about two personal experiences. A few weeks after Keith died, I thought I'd go out, try and get back out on the scene, and I went to a pub. Went to the bar, and I stood in the bar by myself, and it was the biggest moment of isolation I've ever felt mm-hmm. in my life. One of our friends, who only knew me vaguely, one of your friends, Gavin Peter, just came out and said, "Hello, Adam, how are you going?" And I said, "Look, I feel like this." He was so fantastic. Mm. It was really good. Mm. It was so good to me.
Yeah, I have to say that feeling of aloneness is huge, particularly after when they've gone as well, because I think exhaustion, number one, but also it's hard to relate to the rest of the world because it seems like it's just gone on. Like, you know, I've gone through all this and how dare you keep going on as normal, like worrying, people bitching and worrying about such minor things. Mm. But you get over that. Start bitching yourself.
Do you, now that we've lost our partners, do you ever still lose it?
Yeah.
Anita?
Yeah, I lost it Friday morning.
What about you, Leanne?
Not so much. There's still probably some songs I don't play.
Yeah.
I probably don't get as upset now. I get a bit annoyed when I still get mail 6 years later.
Yes.
I always scribble something back. You know, she died 6 years ago. Take her off your list.
It's been 13 years since my partner died, and occasionally I'll be doing something at home and I'll open something and it's his. I tell you the thing that freaked a lot of people out. I got an answering machine and it broke, and I put the old one back on and it had his voice on. Mm-hmm. This was like 7 years after he's died, and here's Keith answering the phone. And one funny thing is, about 10 years after he died, I ran into somebody I hadn't seen for a while, and they said, "Hello, Adam." I said, "Where's Keith? Was not here tonight." I said, "No, he's not." He said, "Oh, because I saw you with him a couple of weeks ago." I said, "Where'd you see?" He said, "You were in the car. You were driving, and you were in his orange car." I said, "Well, that's funny. If he was in the car with me, he must have been in the ashtray because he was cremated 10 years ago." Amazing how people forget. Leanne and Anita, thank you so much for sharing your stories with us. And it's been an important look at how grief and how loss articulate in our lives and how we cope with it. Thank you for sharing your experiences. I know it's been really difficult. Can I ask you one question in wind-up? What's the chances of you getting another partner, Anita?
Pretty remote, I think, mainly because we were together so long. I just...
36 years is amazing.
I couldn't put anybody in the place of trying to be Maureen because it's not fair to them.
Anita,
and I'm not the greatest catch in the world anymore.
I don't think so. 36 years, Anita, we love you. You're one of the stalwarts at this station. Thank you for everything you've done, and thank you for sharing the story of Maureen. And it's fitting that we have this very positive and affirming testimony to her. Leanne?
Well, I said no for several years, but 3 years ago I was on a walking tour in Florence and met someone, and I'm happy and I'm glad that I'm in that relationship, and in no way does it take anything away from the relationship I had with Jennifer. So,
your new partner, do you talk about and remember and celebrate the life of Jen?
A lot, because we're in the house, and so that took some even discussion whether we would live in the same house or not, particularly around changing things, because it was Jennifer's house for much longer before mine.
Okay.
But yeah, no, I think it's important to include it. It would be weird not to.
Yep, I got a new partner and I've had several partners since. I think we might talk now to Carol Ann and just wind up and conclude our discussion. There's a couple of things I wanted to talk about with Carol Ann on this issue. She's somewhat of an expert. Perhaps she can give us a little bit of a wind-up. How did we go, Caroline, in our discussion? Did you think we covered the issues?
Oh, I think that you were wonderfully open and honest about the real experience of grief, which sometimes in the literature or in the public language of grief doesn't really get adequately expressed. And when we talk about grief, when we talk about sadness, when we talk about loss, those are generalized words that as you start to unpack it with real experience and real stories, you sort of discover how nuanced and how complex and those experiences are.
And there's a whole story as well, which is we don't have time for now, but how do you recover from all that? How do you get on with your life and continue on without your partner?
You just do. It just happens. One of the interesting questions I'd like to ask Carol Ann that people frequently, when you look at people who get into relationships with people who they know are facing something quite serious and going to die, the number of times I've said to people, you know, you went through this, would you do it again, and would you still do it if you knew your partner was going to die? And they've all said yes. It's a wonderful testament to human spirit, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And, you know, very often we don't discover until somewhere down the line how trauma, how tragedy, how difficult experiences in our lives change us.
Yes.
You know, they're the gritty things that we go through, and often it's the other people in our lives that sort of point out to us the pearls that have emerged from those experiences. Mm. And I think if you've had that kind of transforming experience in your life, it's something more of you to share. Mm. And as you have come out of your own difficult healing process, there's more of you open to sharing. Mm. And so I'm not at all surprised to hear that people are saying yes to that question.
Can you give us some indication, some advice for people in the community who may be facing, because as I said before, this is one thing that connects all of us across the wide communities that we have in Australia. The one thing that connects us is we're all going to go through grief and loss at some stage. What are some of the things, perhaps positive steps, people can do to give themselves a buffer so they can cope and prepare for grief and loss?
Well, you know, loss is an experience, like many experiences in our lives, that we bring to it everything that we have. We bring to it all of our previous experiences. We bring to it our own capacities, our own strengths, our own resilience, and our own vulnerabilities as well. And so I think the first important thing for people to recognize, as you've said, is that this is part of living. And to try to segregate loss out of living is actually in some way to segregate yourself from some of the more dynamic and important dimensions of living, like having relationships. Mm. You know, we are all mortal beings, as you started the program saying. If we choose not to have a relationship with someone who might die, then we can't have a relationship. So, you know, I think it's a healthy thing to do, to sort of inventory yourselves from time to time and to recognize what one's strengths are and also what one's vulnerabilities are, and to seek out others in your life, to make connections with supportive other people who can actually help you in both of those things, both to remind you to be a mirror to yourself of the strengths that you have and also to support you in your vulnerabilities.
Grief is actually a very important process for mental health.
That's right.
You need to have grief. If you have loss without grief, can I just quickly tell you the story? One other point I'd like to make, particularly for people who don't have partners, the loss of a pet sometimes can cause exactly the same situation. We had to euthanize one of our little dogs a few years ago. My partner, my new partner, who I've been with for 8 years now, but we'd only been together for 2 years, was very attached to this little dog. And when the end of her life came, I said to him, you know, we're going to have him euthanized. So we made an appointment for the vet to come to our house. We're going to sedate the dog and then euthanize the dog. So we didn't, it was completely stress-free for the dog. But the day before, I said, we need to prepare. We need to dig a grave for the dog. So we went out in the garden. And as we started doing it, I was quite okay because I'd resolved it. My partner just broke down. I've never seen him so upset in my life. Digging our dog's grave was the most awful, awful experience for him. He cried and sobbed. I had to do it myself in the end. He just couldn't cope with it. But the fact that he did that, his father died a few months ago, and that process of actually going through grief with the dog seemed to prepare him a little bit. Was that healthy?
Absolutely.
Carol Ann Allen, thank you very much for being on Allegro, and thank you to Anita and to Leanne, and thank you to our listeners. We had a lot of SMS and correspondence. I'm sorry we couldn't include them in the show today, but I'll have a good read of them after the show. We'll be back next week, and we're going to look at celebrating gay relationships on Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Thanks for listening to Allegro Non Troppo. If you'd like more information, feedback or podcasts, go to allegro.org.au. That's allegro.org.au.